What Happened to Me, Part 5 of 6 by Randall Niles. For all the footnotes, resources, and other materials, go to allaboutthejourney.org.
The Jesus of History. You know, Jesus Christ has been called many things by many people, including a great man, a great teacher, a great prophet. There's really no legitimate scholar today that denies that Jesus is a historic figure that walked on this earth about 2,000 years ago, that he did remarkable wonders and acts of charity, and that he died a horrible death on a Roman cross just outside Jerusalem. And like these scholars, I guess I had no problem with this historical Jesus. Similar to Buddha or Confucius, Zoroaster or Muhammad, I view Jesus as just another profound religious leader in history. I must say, as a practicing atheist, I experienced a number of people that totally rejected Jesus as a historic figure, and they staunchly defended their various myth and conspiracy theories. However, I found their arguments to be very weak. I mean, come on, the entire English-speaking world divides history into two principal periods. I mean, B.C., before Christ, and A.D., Anno Domini, for Latin, which is Latin for Year of Our Lord. And whether one subscribes to the B.C.A.D. labels or the new politically correct B.C.E.C.E., you know, the common era labels, the birth of Jesus Christ has always been the dividing line in history. Also, nobody can deny the fact that every leader of every major world religion has confronted the historic person of Jesus. Muslims recognize Jesus as a prophet, while Jews either see him as a blaspheming rebel or an exceptional rabbi elevated to deity by idolatrous Gentiles. Many Buddhists regard Jesus as a Mahatma Giva, which is a perfectly enlightened being who vows to help others. And while there's a Hindu tradition that Jesus was actually a guru who learned meditation in India. Okay, so the person known as Jesus of Nazareth was a historic figure. And again, I really didn't have a problem with that reality, but what about his life and death as recorded in the Bible? Wait, what about all those Old Testament prophecies of a coming Messiah, Christos in Greek? So let's take a look at these prophecies of a coming Messiah. Messianic prophecy is the collection of over 300 predictions in the Jewish scriptures about the future Messiah, the Savior of the Jewish people and the world. And these predictions were written by multiple authors and numerous books over approximately 1,000 years. And although I was now viewing the Bible as a credible source, and I was stunned by some of the historical prophecies I examined in the Old Testament, I just couldn't get over the gap dividing the Old Testament predictions from the New Testament Jesus. It was just too convenient, or maybe it was just too perfect. I had to check them out and test them for myself. So I started reading and collecting the actual scriptures, and I laid out the Old Testament passages and searched for the corresponding New Testament texts. And as my little notebook took shape, it was really powerful. I mean, the Messiah had to fulfill all of these, not just some of them. And the statistical odds started revealing themselves to me, and I must say I was totally baffled. Jesus said, quote, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." Well, here's a brief snapshot of a few prophecies I looked at during my notebook exercise. That he would be born of a virgin, which is in Isaiah 7:14, fulfilled in Matthew, Luke. That he would be born in Bethlehem, of the county of Ephrathah, which is a very specific place in ancient Judea. That would be Micah 5:2, and also fulfilled in Matthew and Luke. That he'd be heralded by a messenger of the Lord, which was in Isaiah 40, 3-5, Malachi 3:1, and this was John the Baptist in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That he would perform miracles, Isaiah 35, 5-6. Again, throughout Matthew and all the rest of the Gospels, we see Jesus performing miracles. That he would preach good news, Isaiah 61, 1-2, as fulfilled in Luke. That he would first present himself as king, actually 173,880 days from the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. And this was in Daniel 9:25 and fulfilled in Matthew, Mark, Luke. That he would enter Jerusalem as a king riding a donkey, Zechariah 9:9, fulfilled in all three of the Gospels I just mentioned. That he would die a humiliating and painful death. That's Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53, as fulfilled in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, John 19 specifically. That his hands and his feet would be pierced. This is Psalm 22, 16. And then we look at the crucifixion accounts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That his executioners would cast lots for his clothing, Psalm 22, 18. That was fulfilled in John. None of his bones would be broken in his execution. This is Psalm 34, 20, as fulfilled in John. His side would be pierced, Zechariah 12, 10, fulfilled in John. That he would die with the wicked and he would be buried in a rich man's tomb, Isaiah 53:9, fulfilled in Matthew. Now, although some of the other predictions I looked at could be called generalized, taken as a whole, these were remarkable to me. I mean, I couldn't get over the odds of just one man fulfilling each and every one of these predictions. Even when I tossed out a few of the more basic ones, I was still absolutely stunned by this statistical impossibility. So was the Jesus of the New Testament really the promised Messiah of the Old Testament? For me, I started to see the mathematical impossibility of just one man, Jesus, accidentally fulfilling or purposely manipulating over 300 predictions written hundreds of years before his birth. Well, Professor Peter Stoner, born in 1888, died in 1980, he discovered the same thing. Stoner was chairman of the Department of Mathematics and Astronomy at Pasadena City College until 1953, and he calculated the probability of one man fulfilling only a handful of the over 300 messianic prophecies. In 1944, he published his research results in the book called Science Speaks, Scientific Proof of the Accuracy of Prophecy in the Bible. Stoner concluded that the probability of one person fulfilling just 8 of the specific prophecies was 1 chance in 10 to the 17th power. That's 1 followed by 17 zeros. How about one person fulfilling just 48 of the over 300 prophecies? Stoner calculated these odds at 1 chance in 10 to the 157th power, way beyond statistical impossibility. Okay, this can't be considered true statistical science, can it? Actually, the American Scientific Affiliation gave Stoner's work their stamp of approval. They said, "The manuscript for Science Speaks has been carefully reviewed by a committee of the American Scientific Affiliation members and by the executive council of the same group and have been found in general to be dependable and accurate in regard to the scientific material presented. The mathematical analysis included is based upon principles of probability which are thoroughly sound, and Professor Stoner has applied these principles in a proper and convincing way." End quote. I was blown away. I had never really looked at this stuff. I had never really thought it all through. I mean, this wasn't generalized stuff. The book of Daniel was written 500 years before the birth of Jesus. And in chapter 9, Daniel predicts the very day that the Messiah would enter Jerusalem and present himself as king for the first time. The prophecy states that 69 weeks of years, that's 69 times 7, which is 483 years, would pass from the decree to rebuild Jerusalem until the coming of the Messiah. And since Daniel was written in Babylon during the Jewish captivity after the fall of Jerusalem, this prophecy was based on the Babylonian 360-day calendar. Thus, 483 years times 360 days equals 173,880 days. Well, according to the records found in the Susa Palace and confirmed in Nehemiah 2:1, the decree to rebuild Jerusalem was issued by the Persian king Artaxerxes Longimanus on March 5th, 444 BC. Remarkably, 173,880 days later, adjusting for some leap years and things, on March 30th, 33 AD, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, fulfilling the prophecy in Zechariah 9:9. And 5 days later, Jesus was crucified on a Roman cross just outside Jerusalem. Actually, the form of his execution and even his last words were foretold hundreds of years earlier in Psalm 22. 3 days later, the New Testament accounts declare that Jesus rose from the dead on Easter Sunday, fulfilling numerous other prophecies of the long-awaited Messiah. You know, I stopped myself. Okay, that's all terrific stuff, but something was holding me back. I mean, I needed more. I needed something to squash my nagging doubt. Where's the evidence that these messianic prophecies weren't written after the death of Jesus by a group of zealots that wanted to deify their departed religious leader? I needed something else. I needed one more piece of evidence that showed these predictions were in black and white prior to the time of Jesus. Well, there it was, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls have been called the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times. They were discovered between 1947 and 1956 in 11 caves along the northwest shore of the Dead Sea in Israel. This is an arid region 13 miles east of Jerusalem and 1,300 feet below sea level. The Dead Sea Scrolls are comprised of the remains of approximately 825 to 870 separate scrolls, represented by tens of thousands of fragments. The texts are most commonly made of animal skins, but also papyrus and one of copper. Most of the texts are written in Hebrew and Aramaic, with a few in Greek. The Dead Sea Scrolls appear to be the library of a Jewish sect considered most likely to be the Essenes. And near the caves are the ancient ruins of Qumran, a village excavated in the early 1950s that shows connections to both the Essenes and the Scrolls. The Essenes were strictly observant Jewish scribes, and the library appears to have been hidden away in caves around the outbreak of the first Jewish revolt, 66 to 70 AD, as the Roman army advanced against the Jews. The Dead Sea Scrolls can be divided into two categories, biblical and non-biblical. The fragments of every book of the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, have been discovered except for the Book of Esther. Now identified among the scrolls are 19 fragments of Isaiah, 25 fragments of Deuteronomy, 30 fragments of the Psalms. The virtually intact Isaiah scroll, which contains some of the most dramatic messianic prophecy, is 1,000 years older than any previously known manuscript of Isaiah. Based on various dating methods, including paleographic, scribal, carbon-14, the Dead Sea Scrolls were written during the period from about 200 BC to 68 AD. Many crucial messianic manuscripts, such as Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, Isaiah 61, date to at least 100 BC. As such, the Dead Sea Scrolls have revolutionized textual criticism of the Old Testament and messianic prophecy. Phenomenally, the biblical texts of Qumran are in substantial agreement with the Masoretic text, Septuagint, and variant translations of the Old Testament we use today. Wow, what a find! I mean, until recently, in historic terms, the extra piece of evidence I needed didn't exist, and now it does. We now have dramatic evidence that the key messianic prophecies contained in today's Old Testament are the same messianic prophecies that existed prior to the time Jesus walked this earth. There was no contrivance after the fact. There was no conspiracy. Simply, Jesus fulfilled the requirements of the Jewish Messiah. So my study of archaeology had gone full circle. The Dead Sea Scrolls sat untouched in a perfect arid environment for approximately 2,000 years. And in 1947, a Bedouin shepherd stumbles upon arguably the most important archaeological find in history. Then 1 year later, against tremendous odds, the Jewish people return to their homeland as a formal nation for the first time since 70 AD, fulfilling a number of major historical prophecies. Wow, I really felt a sense of wonder. I mean, we really live in a remarkable time in history. For me, I now had the utmost confidence that the Old Testament that we read today is substantially the same as existed before the birth of Jesus. This means that the over 300 Old Testament prophecies of the coming Messiah were in black and white before the New Testament writers were even on the scene. Wait, is this circular reasoning? I mean, I spotted another potential issue here. I've just established that the Old Testament predictions of a coming Messiah pre-existed Jesus, but the only thing telling me that Jesus was the person who fulfilled these predictions is the New Testament. Therefore, I have one religious book being used to support the prophecies in another religious book, the New Testament accounts to document the Old Testament prophetic fulfillment. Isn't that circular reasoning? Aren't we using the Bible to validate the Bible? I went back and I looked at my notes regarding the Bible, and I was reminded that the Bible is often viewed as one book, and therefore criticized on the basis of self-fulfilling integrity. However, the Bible is comprised of 66 separate and distinct texts written by some 40 authors who often had nothing to do with each other. If we view each text on its own, the level of validity and corroboration within the biblical volume itself is remarkable. The Bible actually validates itself through the inherent design that bonds its 66 separate books together in one integrative work. When objectively analyzed, why should we have a problem using the 27 New Testament texts to help validate the 39 Old Testament texts? We're merely using one collection of ancient historical documents to establish the veracity of another collection of ancient historical documents. Academic historians do this all the time. I stop myself again. I grasp this concept with respect to the 39 books of the Old Testament, where hundreds of years separated the authors and texts. However, since the 27 books of the New Testament were put together in a fairly short period of time, maybe they were more apt to be contrived as a whole by a tightly connected group of conspiring zealots. And what about that? Are there any corroborating sources outside this tight-knit religious group? Then I remembered my initial study of Tacitus in part two, and I recalled that other writers recorded biblical events outside the Bible. Therefore, although I was well on my way to deflating the circular reasoning argument regarding the Bible, I realized I could avoid this issue altogether by returning to the extra-biblical historical documentation of Old Testament prophetic fulfillment. For example, is there any documentation outside the New Testament that shows that Jesus was executed as predicted in Jewish scriptures such as Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53? Well, guess what? There is. I soon discovered there are numerous non-Christian sources outside the biblical texts that corroborate the events of the New Testament. In fact, there are a variety of extra-biblical sources that directly mention Jesus Christ and the rise of Christianity. I found this stunning. I mean, how could I discredit sources of historical evidence that weren't sympathetic to the person of Jesus or the cause of Christianity? In law, a witness that's either indifferent or antagonistic to the matter in question can be the most powerful testimony available. I was more than intrigued. I started checking out some of these early disinterested sources. I started with the historian Tacitus, since I had just read his small yet powerful piece on Pontius Pilate and Christus, which is Christ. Cornelius Tacitus, he lived from 55 to 120 AD, was considered a great historian of ancient Rome. His masterpiece, Annals, is represented by a two-volume set, with one surviving manuscript in chapters 1 to 6, and 32 surviving manuscripts in chapters 11 to 16, which is known as Historii. And his background, on July 19, 64 AD, a fire started in Rome that burned for 9 days, finally destroying nearly three-quarters of the city. And according to Tacitus, rumors spread that the fire was planned by the wickedly unstable Emperor Nero himself. In response, Nero created a diversion by calling for the torture and execution of Christians. Here is the actual language from Tacitus. Quote, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, for the first source of the evil, but even in Rome itself, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus when he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or stood aloft in a car. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed." So from Tacitus, probably the leading Roman historian of the period, there's no doubt that Christians existed in 64 AD. In addition, they faced hideous persecution for their belief in Christ, a true historical figure who was executed in Judea during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilate. So let's go to the next one, Flavius Josephus, who lived from 37 to 100 AD. A Jewish general and member of the priestly aristocracy of the Jews, turned to the side of the Roman Empire in the Great Jewish Revolt of 66 to 70 AD. Josephus spent the rest of his life in or around Rome as an advisor and historian to three emperors, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. For centuries, the works of Josephus were more widely read in Europe than any book other than the Bible. They are invaluable sources of eyewitness testimony to the development of Western civilization, including the foundation and growth of Christianity in the first century. Remarkably, Josephus mentions New Testament events and people in some of his works. For me, this was some of the most significant evidence against the legend theories that plagued my view of early Christianity. Here are some excerpts I found fascinating, and others can be found at the resource at allaboutthejourney.org. At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, and those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. Wow, that's powerful stuff from Antiquities, Book 18, Chapter 3, Paragraph 3. Even more phenomenal, that's from the Arabic manuscript. Even more phenomenal is the Greek version of this text, which many scholars have declared was doctored because it was so incredible. However, this version was quoted as early as the 300s AD. So here's the Greek version. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ, and when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named for him are not extinct at this day. Wow, the Greek version's even more impactful. And the quotes go on and on. Please go to allaboutthejourney.org to see those. So these and the other quotes that I list from Josephus really speak for themselves. Professor Shlomo Pines, a well-known Israeli scholar, discusses the fact of Jesus' historicity and the references to Jesus by Josephus, and he says, "In fact, as far as probabilities go, no believing Christian could have produced such a neutral text. For him, the only significant point about it could have been its attesting the historical evidence of Jesus. But the fact is that until modern times, this particular hare, i.e. claiming Jesus is a hoax, was never started. Even the most bitter opponents of Christianity never expressed any doubt as to Jesus having really lived." End quote. Let's go on to Pliny the Younger. He lived between 62 and about 113 AD, and he was the Roman governor of Bithynia, which is present-day northwestern Turkey, about 111, 112 AD, he wrote the following letter to Emperor Trajan of Rome, asking for advice on how to deal with Christians, because he didn't know how to deal with them. Quote, "It's a rule, sir, which I inviolably observe, to refer myself to you in all my doubts, for who is more capable of guiding my uncertainty or informing my ignorance? Having never been present at any trials of the Christians, I am unacquainted with the method and limits to be observed either in examining or punishing them. Whether any difference is to be allowed between the youngest and the adult, whether repentance admits to a pardon, or if a man has been once a Christian, it avails him nothing to recant, whether the mere profession of Christianity, albeit without crimes, or only the crimes associated therewith are punishable. In all these points I am greatly doubtful. In the meanwhile, the method I have observed towards those who have denounced to me as Christians is this. I interrogated them whether they were Christians, and if they confessed, I repeated the question twice again, adding the threat of capital punishment. And if they still persevered, I ordered them to be executed. For whatever the nature of their creed might be, I could at least feel no doubt that contumacy and inflexible obstinacy deserve chastisement. There were others who possessed with the same infatuation, but being citizens of Rome, I directed them to be carried thither. These accusations spread, as is usually the case, from the mere fact of a matter being investigated, and several forms of the mischief came to light. A placard was put up, without any signature, accusing a large number of persons by name, and those who denied they were or had ever been Christians, who repeated after me an invocation to the gods and offered adoration with wine and frankincense to your image, which I had ordered to be brought for that purpose, together with those of the gods, and who finally cursed Christ, none of which acts it into its performing these, I thought it proper to discharge. Others who were named by that informer or first confessed themselves Christians and then denied it, true, they had been of that persuasion, but they had quitted it. Some 3 years, others many years, and a few as much as 25 years ago. They all worshipped your statue and the images of gods and cursed Christ." This letter goes on and on talking about singing hymns to Christ and how these people acted as Christians prior to being persecuted. And you can see that at allaboutthejourney.org. This is quite a letter preserved from antiquity, and I reproduced a great deal of it on the web because it's so powerful for me in its entirety. It speaks of Christianity spreading throughout the Roman Empire. It addresses the procedure for persecuting followers out of this superstition. It also mentions Christ by name three times and the center of Christianity, and describes Christian practices, including the worship of Christ as to a god. So this is powerful stuff. Let's go on to Suetonius. He was a secretary and historian to Hadrian, emperor of Rome, from 117 to 138 AD. And regarding Emperor Claudius and the riot of Rome in 49 AD, Suetonius wrote, "As the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Christ, he," which was Claudius, "expelled them from Rome." Interestingly, Acts 18:2 relates that Paul met Aquila and his wife Priscilla just after they left Italy because Claudius had expelled them. So this ties into to the Acts of the Apostles there. Later, Suetonius wrote about the Great Fire of Rome in 64 AD, and he wrote, quote, "Punishment by Nero was inflicted on the Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition," end quote. Marabar Sarapion, he's a Stoic philosopher from Syria, wrote this letter to his son from prison sometime after 70 AD. Quote, "What advantage did the Athenians gain from putting Socrates to death? Famine and plague came upon them as a judgment for their crime. What advantage did the men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment their land was covered with sand. And what advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that their kingdom was abolished. God justly avenged these three wise men. The Athenians died of hunger, the Samians were overwhelmed by the sea, and the Jews, ruined and driven from their land, live in complete dispersion. But Socrates did not die for good. He lived on in the statue of Plato. And Pythagoras did not die for good. He lived on in the statue of Hera. Nor did the wise king die for good. He lived on in the teaching which he had given." Now, this letter refers to Jesus as being the wise king. And the writer is obviously not a Christian because he places Jesus on an equal level with Socrates and Pythagoras. Without bias in his reference to Jesus and the church, this letter is a valuable historical reference regarding the historicity of Jesus. And then we go to Lucian, a 2nd century Greek philosopher. And this preserved text I'm about to read is obviously satirical, but it's a powerful extra-biblical source. Quote, "The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. You see, these misguided creatures started with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt of death and voluntary self-devotion which are so common among them. And then it was impressed them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment that they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live under his laws. All this they take quite on faith, with the result that they despise all worldly goods alike, regarding them merely as common property," end quote. This piece is unflattering at best, but it's obviously supportive of the person of Jesus Christ, the, quote, crucified sage, and the survival of the Christian church into the second century. Of all the ancient sources for Jesus, probably the least favorably biased seem to be the rabbinic in origin. There are actually a significant number of references to Jesus, but many of them use names like that man or when they refer to Jesus. Therefore, some of the references are now considered rather unreliable. Regardless, in the Babylonian Talmud, the formal commentary on the Jewish laws compiled between 200 and 500 AD, there's a powerful reference to Jesus. Quote, "It has been taught on the eve of the Passover that they hanged Yeshua, and an announcer went out in front of him for 40 days, saying, 'He is going to be stoned because he is practicing sorcery and enticing and leading Israel astray. Anyone who knows anything in his favor, let him come and plead in his behalf.' But not having found anything in his favor, they hanged him on the eve of the Passover," end quote. This is considered to be very credible Jewish reference to Jesus, Yeshua. And here the rabbinical writers verify that Jesus was a historic figure, that he was crucified on the eve of the Passover, and that he did miracles, referred to as sorcery here. And the events surrounding the life of Jesus were not denied, but definitely verified. Well, I was looking for unbiased sources outside the Bible that speak to the person of Jesus, his death by capital punishment, and the rise of a religion in his name, and remarkably, that's exactly what I got. The non-Christian historical accounts of Cornelius Tacitus, Flavius Josephus, Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, Mara Bar Sepion, Lucian, and even the writings of the extremely biased Jewish Sanhedrin all vindicate the biblical accounts of the life and death of Jesus Christ in the first century AD. In addition to the 9 New Testament authors who wrote about Jesus in separate accounts, I found at least 20 additional early Christian authors, 4 heretical writings, and 7 non-Christian sources that make explicit mention of Jesus in their writings within 150 years of his life. This amounts to a minimum of 40 authors, all of whom explicitly mention Jesus and the expansion of a spiritual movement in his name. More authors mention Jesus Christ within 150 years of his life than mention the Roman emperor who reigned during his lifetime. Scholars are only aware of 10 sources that mention Emperor Tiberius within 150 years of his life, including Luke, Tacitus, Suetonius, and Paterculus. Thus, within this short time frame, the number of ancient writers who mention Jesus outnumber those who mention the leader of the entire Roman Empire, that's effectively the ancient world of the time, by a ratio of 4-1. All right, that's fantastic evidence for the historical life and death of a religious leader named Jesus Christ. But what about the rest? What about the alleged miracles? What about the greatest miracle of all? His resurrection from the dead. Well, that's the end of this section of part 3 to What Happened to Me. For the final segment, please go to allaboutthejourney.org and click on the podcast there.